second case this morning, Sperling v. C&M Fine Packing. Jansen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a case dealing with the ADA, the FMLA, and what we believe is the District Court's finding an error that the company C&M had no knowledge of Sperling's disability at the time that it made the decision to end her employment. While working for the company, my client, Kimberly Sperling, suffered from severe sleep issues. At an April 15th suspension pending termination meeting, the company told Kimberly Sperling verbally and in writing that if she could give it any reason to sway its decision before Monday, they might not end her employment. The time provided to her was customary. The company said, "We typically review termination decisions for up to 2 weeks. We try to gather all the information we can so that we make a good decision." And the corporate HR person told me he had overruled termination decisions on several occasions. Sperling took them up on their offer. She called the very next day and told them that she believed her sleep issues might be related to a medical condition. The HR representative that she spoke to...
Did she do that on the basis of after having consulted a physician or just on her own?
No, that was on her own. She told him, "I have made an appointment with my physician." He told her good. He didn't say, "It's too little, too late. I've recommended your termination." Instead, he welcomed her to come back to the company. He said, "I will give you the forms to take to the doctor." She came. She picked up the forms. He actually sent an email to his corporate vice president of human resources, and he said, "Kimberly Sperling has contacted me. I've placed her on a leave of absence. She's going to go to the doctor, and when she's finished with this progress, we'll decide." That was, I think, key to the case. He took her completely out of the suspension process and put her on a leave of absence. The corporate HR didn't say to him, no, let's not do that. You've already recommended her termination. He didn't say it was too little, too late. He didn't say you shouldn't have put her on a leave. The company form that they gave Kimberly Sperling to take to the doctor asked the doctor, "Does the employee listed have a mental or physical disability covered under the ADA?" The doctor checked yes. There is no space on the form for a diagnosis. There's no space on the form for really anything else. The doctor gratuitously wrote on, "Patient has excessive drowsiness that affects her job." At the bottom of the form, he wrote, "Additional medical workup in progress." C&M, the district court, faulted this form. The district court said it didn't give the company any notice that she had a disability. The company argues that it was vacuous. We would argue it's the company's form. They didn't ask for a diagnosis. And a diagnosis is not required under law. I checked Seventh Circuit case law, and I apologize if there is such a case, but I couldn't find one. I found a case in Ohio and a case in Oregon that definitively stated you don't need a diagnosis. It's not required. All you have to have is knowledge of the disability. We believe this form gave them more than sufficient knowledge of the disability. And if
Ms. Jansen, if I could, let me just
certainly
tell you what troubles me. I frankly, as I was reading through the briefs in this case, thought that answer from the doctor was kind of vacuous until I realized that it was indeed from the company's own form. If I understand your briefing correctly, you agree that the defendant could have fired the plaintiff back in February, the sleeping incident, February of 2010, where she got the warning, right?
I don't remember addressing that. They could have fired her at any time. They could have fired her.
She was an employee at will, and they had
right,
no.
Right, sure.
There was no ADA issue back in February.
Absolutely.
And you were quite explicit in saying they could have fired her after the April 12th. Immediately after the April 12th sleeping incident where she had been denying any medical condition, right?
They could have. That was not their policy.
Okay. Right. What troubles me here on your side, in essence, is that the plaintiff had repeatedly denied there was a medical cause.
Correct. Correct.
Mr. Bellant, the HR guy at the specific plant, gives her the time to submit additional information. He receives it. As you argue, the company basically ignored it or turned a blind eye to it. In essence, I'm worried about a rule that would, in essence, resonate with the old saw that no good deed goes unpunished, that in essence that the employer winds up in trouble under the expensive trouble under the ADA because they were flexible and open to considering more information when they could have just fired her. Could you address my concern?
I hope so, Your Honor. I don't think that's the case here because they didn't really fire her for that reason. If you look at the final emails that went back and forth, April 27th, she had been on a leave of absence for 11 days. And the corporate HR said, what's your recommendation? How do you want to proceed? They responded the following day, the company did, and they said, we recommend the aggressive approach despite the warnings from corporate counsel. We feel we did the interactive process during her progressive discipline when she told us she didn't have a medical condition. Well, at that time, if we're going to adopt a new standard that says you get the interactive process before you know you have a disability, we need guidance from the court on that. She couldn't have known she needed a reasonable accommodation. She hadn't been to the doctor to even trigger the process. At the end of that email, they said the doctor's suggestion for reasonable accommodations are not reasonable. They can't claim they didn't have notice of her disability and then discuss the interactive process and reasonable accommodations in the email when they decide to fire her because they didn't want to give a reasonable accommodation. And their testimony was very clear during deposition. We have had other employees that are disabled ask us for reasonable accommodations. I said, what did you do? We've never given a reasonable accommodation. This email makes it clear they knew that they had a disabled employee here, but they were not going to start giving reasonable accommodations.
Was the doctor involved in providing the company information at that point?
The doctor filled out the company form, which was returned to the company. The district court faulted the form. He said it didn't give the company enough information. The company faults its own form, which says she's covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I argued Baltimore.
Can I take you off of Baltimore?
Sure.
Baltimore involves mental illness and kind of has its own unique characteristics.
It does.
But I thought your principal theory on this point was the doctor provided the information in the company's own form. There was a deliberate decision, at least a jury could so find, by the corporation not to follow up with the doctor. And you had the doctor testify that, yeah, I would have been happy to provide additional details and discuss this further if anybody had bothered to call.
Absolutely.
That's all correct?
That is all correct. The doctor testified. No one called me. He also said, I understand the FMLA. I would have approved an FMLA leave for her to finish her medical testing. And this court has found that a 2 to 4 week leave, which is all she needed to complete her medical testing, could be a reasonable accommodation. That's also part of our FMLA interference claim.
What was the rest and snacks or something? Wasn't there some sort of suggestion that that be an accommodation?
The doctor on the form wrote, all he wrote was periods of scheduled rest as a possible accommodation. He didn't write anything on the form about snacks on the line. And again, my point with Baltimore was they never called the doctor. They never worked with Kimberly Sperling. They didn't follow the interactive process. Yet in their final email, it says, we gave her the interactive process when the poor woman still didn't even know she's falling asleep on the job. If you read the notes from the suspension meeting, they're telling her your coworkers are waking you up. And she's saying, that never happened. It never happened. Because with narcolepsy, you don't know when you're asleep. I mean, the poor woman was seeing a doctor. The doctor said, you have nerves, you have anxiety. Put her on an antidepressant. She got Dr. Beitzel by accident because her doctor was on vacation. He recognized right away that she had, he said, a very, very severe sleep apnea or other severe medical condition. That's why he referred her.
Sleep apnea or narcolepsy?
He thought at the time she had a very severe sleep apnea or another severe type medical sleep condition. That's why he referred her to a sleep specialist. Right, he referred her to a sleep specialist, and that's why he wrote additional medical workup in progress. Again, with our FMLA claim, we don't believe the company can ignore that. They knew she needed more testing. They had FMLA available because they already had her on a leave of absence. It makes no sense for them to yank her off of it and say, well, you're terminated because we don't want to accommodate you. We can't accommodate you with the doctor's suggestions. But they never talked to the doctor because he would have suggested, let's just leave her off of work for a week or two while she gets this testing done.
I understand, Ms. Jansen, your ADA claim. I have a little trouble following the FMLA reasoning, which provides time off. And here she was already off, and the termination process was well underway. And I think we've got some cases, if I recall correctly, that say, in essence, you don't have to stop that process with this kind of 11th-hour request for time off.
You know, Your Honor, I would agree with you. There are a lot of cases that say that, but this case is different because the company customarily reviewed for 2 weeks. They encouraged her to come in. They gave her their form. They did everything, and then at the end, when they found out she really needed an accommodation, they hit the brakes and said, no, we don't give accommodations. We're not going to follow the law.
Okay, so where in the definition of a serious medical condition under the FMLA does she fall as of April 28th?
Well, as of April 28th, she had a serious medical condition. She either had a severe sleep apnea or another illness that was not yet diagnosed.
Point to the part of the definition that would apply.
Well, there's a part of the statute says continuing treatment includes exams to determine if a serious condition exists and evaluations of the condition. That's part of the statute. I believe it's 29 CFR 825.115A. She needed continuing treatment.
That sounds like the regs, is it?
Yeah, it is.
What's the site again?
29 CFR section 825.115A. And, Your Honor, my time is up. My light is on.
That's your rebuttal time.
I know. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Mishlove?
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, clerks. May it please the court. I'm a little frustrated because Judge Hamilton took the sting out of most of my argument today.
I may give you some back.
I'm sure I will get it.
Because he's a former trial judge.
I'd like to begin by highlighting...
As we all are.
I'd like to begin by highlighting the fact that Ms. Sperling repeatedly told CNM that she didn't have a medical condition that was causing her to fall asleep. She repeatedly told them she didn't need an accommodation. There's no reason Ms. Sperling couldn't have or shouldn't have gone to see her physician back in February when she got suspended, or in October when she was having problems. It wasn't until she was her employment was indefinitely suspended pending termination that she had a wake-up call, no pun intended, and went to see her physician. It's entirely foreseeable for her to have made a doctor's appointment and said to them while she was still employed, I need to go look into why I'm falling asleep. She didn't do that until after she was suspended pending termination.
That was on the 16th of April.
Yes, sir.
And the next day she did call and says she thinks there's medication causing her problem.
That was back in February. The medication one was back in February.
But it was on the 21st of April that she got back with the doctor's answer to your question, right? Does she have an ADA disability? The answer is yes. I understand your point. If you had fired her in February of 2010, if you'd fired her immediately in response to the events of April 12th, but given the invitation that was extended and the delay in the decision to fire her, it's a little hard for me, frankly, to see how the company could, quote, take the aggressive approach and close its eyes to the information that had been provided.
Well, my response to that is this. The ADA doesn't require the company, didn't require the company, to give her any opportunity to do anything.
No, it doesn't.
And
but it did.
This
and we have case law, the case law that you rely upon, Hedberg, that makes very clear that deliberate ignorance of an employee's disability is actionable.
Understood, Your Honor, but I don't think that there was any deliberate ignorance here, because what came back to us was vacuous. Now, we can fault the company.
You asked the question.
Understood.
You got that answer. So why, if that wasn't enough, why not follow up?
Well, because at that point, you know, consistent with a lot of case law that says you don't have to forgive past misconduct, they were giving her an opportunity to provide some additional information. And at that point, the ball was really in her court.
This is the aggressive approach. She provided you the information, and then you closed your eyes to it. Why is that not a fair, a reasonable reading? Not the only reading, but a reasonable reading of the facts.
I think the aggressive approach means you guys have done everything that you're required to do by the law. You're entitled to terminate her. But there's a good risk that you're going to end up spending tens of thousands of dollars in litigation, which they have, which is why we're here, if you go that route. They believe that they
are potentially paying it to her.
Or potentially pay to her. They believe that they had done everything the law required. They had repeatedly given her the opportunity to let them know if she had a medical condition.
Did they suggest that she see a doctor?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that they suggested that she see a doctor. But it is clear that back in February, she was seeing a doctor. She was receiving medication for an unrelated disorder. She testified in her deposition. She thought she had a medical condition back then, but she never told that to anybody, certainly didn't tell the company. And to the contrary, she told the company that it was caused by medication that was confirmed by her physician. No one thought that had anything to do with a sleep disorder, because both she and her doctor were telling the company this isn't about a sleep condition.
The side effect, apparently, of the medication she was taking was drowsiness and sleepiness or whatever.
I think that the side effect was that it was the wrong medication and it may have caused her to pass out that night.
Would you agree, Mr. Mishlove, that if she had come in with a diagnosis of narcolepsy and information that she was being prescribed drugs to control it, that she could not have been fired on this basis?
If she would have come in with that information when, Your Honor?
Any time before she was fired.
If she came in with that information any time before the termination process was set into motion.
No. Let's
I'm coming back to your question.
Those are two separate issues, but you go ahead. Okay.
Yeah. My answer is, if it was the first one, absolutely. They could not have. They could have extended a reasonable accommodation if there was a reasonable accommodation. After the fact, after she's engaged in the misconduct that is admittedly conduct that is subject to discipline, subject to termination at that point, no. My position is that the company didn't have an obligation to do a reasonable accommodation, because as the...
Okay, so you're saying that if her doctor had come back on the 21st and had said not just she has a disability, but it's narcolepsy and drugs are controlling it and no accommodation is needed now that we've got this under control, you could still have gone forward with firing her?
Yes,
on the
Your
basis
Honor.
Of having fallen
that
asleep.
Is my position. And the company's free to extend greater latitude than the law requires, but the ADA doesn't require it to do so.
The EEOC... on the question of the timing...
Yes, sir.
I'm troubled here. First of all, who was the decision-maker?
Well, if you look at that last email from Mr. Swoyer to Mr. Bellant that says, what do you want to do? How do you want to proceed? One certainly gets the sense that Mr. Bellant was actually the one that was going to make the call, although as a formal matter, the local HR person doesn't have that authority.
So under your structure, in essence, you've got room, both sides in essence have room to argue whether Sawyer or at the corporate level or Bellant at the plant level is the decision maker, right?
I'm totally conceding that at the end of the day, Mr. Swoyer makes the approval.
Okay. And that doesn't happen until April 28th, right?
April 27th or April 28th.
Well,
it was communicated to her on
his
the 28th.
Memo of the 27th says, what do you want to do?
Right.
He's not answered until the 28th, right?
As far as I can tell.
That's what your emails show.
Okay.
So April 28th is the date of the decision. It's subject to reconsideration up until then, right?
It is subject to reconsideration. Okay.
There's no final decision to fire her.
The fact that the decision that came from the local plant, the fact that the local people are amenable to reconsidering their view, ought not inure to their detriment. Reasonable accommodations, according to the EEOC and as this court has recognized, is always prospective. Accommodation under the ADA is always prospective. Therefore, excusing prior misconduct or giving a second chance is not a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. Siefkin versus Village of Arlington. Okay, and that comes from the EEOC. I think it would be unfortunate for employers and employees, perhaps everyone except Ms. Sperling, if having an automatic review process that is designed to ensure compliance with the laws is something that ultimately is construed as returning the parties to the status quo ante before the termination proceedings began, and gives them a new window of time when they can advise their employers that they have a disability that entitles them to accommodation. I applaud them for having the policy. I would hate to see them penalized for it. I think that it's in everyone's best interest, including the court, to allow that kind of review. But if the court's going to say, well, that opens a new window of time where they can tell you that they have a disability and you need to accommodate it, even though she's suspended indefinitely pending termination, I think that that would be a disincentive for employers to have those kind of policies, and I don't think that we ought to discourage them from doing so. Moving on to the FMLA just a little bit. Just like the ADA doesn't require employers to excuse misconduct, this court said in Pagel a year ago, the FMLA does not require an employer to adjust its performance standards for the time an employee is actually on the job. Ms. Sperling was on indefinite suspension pending termination. What does she need leave for? She didn't need leave to go see a doctor. She worked third shift. She went and sees her doctor during the day. Common sense suggests that not a lot of doctors are seeing patients between 11 o'clock and 7:20 in the morning. She didn't need any sort of leave. Leave from what at that point? Leave from her suspension? The whole notion of her requesting some time off to figure out what's going on at that point is somewhat incoherent in and of itself. But in all events, the FMLA really isn't implicated here at all because it's undisputed and undisputable, in fact admitted, that she never requested any sort of leave until after she was suspended pending termination. I'd like to say a word or two about the Beitzel, Dr. Beitzel, if that's how you say it, ADA paperwork. Here's Dr. Beitzel's testimony about that document, and I think it's important because the company correctly regarded it as providing no information. And I would like to mention that when this court is doing summary judgment in ADA cases, it's not infrequent for you to get a conclusory affidavit from a plaintiff's expert saying that she's disabled, saying that her medical condition substantially interferes with her ability to engage in major life activities. The court routinely holds that those sorts of conclusory affidavits from physicians are insufficient to defeat summary judgment precisely because...
Right. For very good reasons. But if that's what your form asks for, it's a trap. Right? If that's what your form asks for, and then you say, that's not good enough, and we're not going to listen to it, I really have trouble with that, counsel.
I understand the trouble that you have. As a practical matter, Your Honor, doctors, just like Dr. Beitzel, write things on those notes other than just checking the box. Now, I understand that the form doesn't require them to do that, but he certainly did. And the ball was in her court. She's facing termination. She ought to come in with – is my time up?
You just didn't rebuttal, so you don't have a rebuttal, so you have how many minutes?
Okay. Here's what Dr. Beitzel has to say. The paper that I got to fill out regarding the Americans Disability Act was an unusual form for me to fill out, and I was told that it was given by the company that I had to fill out, so I wrote on there some extra notation because I felt uncomfortable filling out that form. Question: what made you feel uncomfortable about filling out that form? Answer: I'd never filled out a form for Americans with Disabilities Act before. So can you say with a reasonable degree of medical certainty that she had a condition covered by the Americans, that she in fact had one covered by the American with Disabilities Act in April of 2010? Objection, Your Honor, objection during the deposition, that calls for a legal conclusion.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself capable of making that determination or to state that opinion? I don't know that I'm capable of making that decision. I'm making a medical decision. This is what he had decided at that time. I'm making a medical decision that she was tired and fatigued, and I thought she ought to be off work for a period of time. So can you state with a reasonable degree of medical certainty that she had a sleep disorder condition in April of 2010? Answer, no. And she was not actually diagnosed with a specific sleep condition, narcolepsy, until May. That's correct.
Well, but... That was the problem. It was obvious that she was, or at least it seems obvious in retrospect, she was having a sleep problem. But there are a number of sleep problems that you have to narrow down to figure out what they are.
Understood, Your Honor. And she had a year to do so before she was terminated. Very quickly, I'd like to come back to the question of whether or not she had an FMLA qualifying condition. The response was, well, she had to have these doctor's appointments and doctor's appointments to be evaluated count. But what she's disregarding in that regard is that that prong requires an incapacity of 3 days, and there's no evidence that Ms. Sperling was ever incapacitated for 3 days. With respect to the other potentially applicable prong, the chronic condition, Ms. Sperling herself testified that she only needs to go back once a year. The regulations specify that those chronic conditions, you need to be seen at least twice a year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. How much time does...
Just a few points, Your Honors. Again, the company said, give us any reason to reevaluate our decision. They jumped into the process with her. They put her on a leave of absence of their own free will. They gave her their form to use, which now they still say is an insufficient form. They testified that they didn't have to follow it because it was just the doctor's opinion that she suffered from a disability protected by the ADA. Well, that's what doctors do. Doctors give you their opinion. And he said it. He checked yes. They were on notice that she had a disability. The company took the aggressive approach because they knew what they didn't want to know. They knew they were dealing with someone with a disability that was going to require an accommodation. And their email makes it clear they were not going to give her an accommodation. They didn't interact with her. No interactive process.
Ms. Jansen, could you address more directly defense counsel's argument that, in essence, it would be a really bad policy to interpret the ADA, in essence, to discourage companies from using the kind of process that was used here, at least up until the company decided to close its eyes to what the doctor had said?
The company...
That is, to say, give us some reason to reevaluate.
Well, the company found out she had a disability. They can't then decide to violate the law. The ADA protected Kimberly Sperling. You can't go into the process and say, well, we'll review it for up to 2 weeks, But if we feel like not following the law, we're just going to go ahead and terminate it. They don't have the right to
violate. I understand your legal argument, but where there's some play in the joints in interpreting the statute, I'm concerned about interpreting it in such a way as to discourage employers from waiting and inviting further information.
This case is unique in its fact patterns, Your Honor. Had they terminated her immediately, I wouldn't be here. But they didn't. They took the affirmative step not to. I don't think
that's
they
what
should
worries
be.
Me.
But they did. They launched into it, and then they said, gee, we found out something that we don't like, so now we're going to cry that we don't like the form we got, say it was insufficient, when really she's being terminated. Her misconduct was the disability. It was the disability, and now they know they have an answer to it, that they gave her the chance to give them. They can't then decide not to follow the law.
If she was doing packing, whatever, in an assembly line
yes.
sort of thing, and it was in the hours which normally most people are asleep, right?
Yes, she worked third shift, yes. But they noted that she was packing literally with, she was sleeping, they said packing with her eyes open and packing with her eyes closed.
Yeah,
walking down the halls with, they knew she was asleep, but she's walking down the hall.
My question to you is, though, is this an endemic problem on that line at that particular time with people without a medical problem going to sleep?
The company said that, yes, they have problems with people that work third shift that never adjust to third shift.
It's through a little different. I mean, she had a medical problem. Other people just were going to sleep because it was late at night.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. And her symptoms clearly showed this was not a standard falling asleep. You don't walk down the hall while you're sleeping. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.